Welcome to Be Simply. This is she, and I want to thank you for joining us today. We have Jonathan Miller Weisberger connecting with us and sharing the wisdom from his recently released book, Rainforest Medicine, Preserving Indigenous Science and Biodiversity in the Upper Amazon. He has a beautiful retreat in the Guaira de Osa in Costa Rica, and he will share what he has discovered in his time there and in Ecuador. Without further ado, let's dive in with Jonathan. So Jonathan, I want to thank you for joining us today to dive into your recent publication, Rainforest Medicine, Preserving Indigenous Science and Biodiversity in the Upper Amazon. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Being that you're out and about and talking about this book, I know from my own personal experience, when you go to write a book, then it's a process. I would like to know, in this moment, now that you've gone through that whole process and now we're delivering it to the world, what's sticking out to you most about it?
Well, it's nice to have been able to document the information and to, you know, before it was sort of like my experiences in a way, like I have them all, I mean, many of them I remember with great, you know, inspiration and feel fortunate to have had these experiences. In a way, as time goes by, it's like a river. You know, that, and you just keep flowing down the river and the experience your way up at the headwaters, you're down now way at the lowlands, the environment everywhere has changed. So, and new, you know, situations arise that you got to deal with. So it was nice to be able to accomplish that book because it's a product basically of, you know, 10 solid years between 1990 and the year 2000 living at ground level. And then also since 1990 to the year 2010, returning to Ecuador at least once a year, guiding some trips down there and also to visit the elders and the communities. And also since the sequoias, we bring them up once a year or sometimes twice a year to the lodge in Costa Rica. It's been a way to continue asking more questions and refine some. The book has allowed me to hone in more, you know, on my experiences and also, like, you know, see where the gaps of some of them have been in order to fill in the gaps of knowledge and, you know, had the opportunity to continually working with the elders over the years to ask more questions and at least to, you know, capture a portion that is significant enough to tackle such a subtitle as the book has.
Yes. And being about preservation, because having had the opportunity to see you in your creation down in Guardiosa in Costa Rica and the Oso Peninsula, if you could speak a little bit to the importance of preservation, because when you're there, you feel completely removed from anything that's existing on the planet, really, other than if you're experiencing climate issues, right, because of what you've done to be sustainable. But if you can share a little bit about what that word means from you, from Indigenous science to how we as individuals, no matter where we live in the world, can actually create an impact towards assisting this subheader on your book.
Oh, great. Thank you. Just a minor little correction in the pronunciation of our eco lodge in Costa Rica. It's Guaria.
Guaria. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. Not without, it doesn't carry an accent on the. It's actually pronounced Guaria. Guaria de Osa. Guaria de Osa. It's orchid. Orchid of the Osa. Mm. It chose that name because the name, the orchid, is the symbol of the newness or the freshness of nature. So the objective of the lodge is to share the newness or the freshness of nature with people. That's been such a big inspiration for me, and that is, I know what it's done for me, you know, like through experiences in the wilderness or with cultural, you know, masters. It's like that newness, that freshness is helps us when we touch that. It's easier to tap into the energy of renewal within ourselves. And that's also what the Indigenous science is, all the abilities to achieve renewal. So that's kind of what Indigenous science is about, and different methods of achieving renewal. And that's an important thing for everybody everywhere the world over, because that's, I mean, you know, in essence, we're all Indigenous people of the earth. We're all people with a life and, you know, the need to eat, to, you know, to feed ourselves, the need for shelter. we share the same basic needs. Now the important thing is people the world over have to see how we can redirect our orientation towards one of sustainability, towards one of symbiosis, and towards one of constructing positive transformations, not negative transformations as we see happening for, you know, with the dominant paradigm of, you know, corporate consumer culture in many ways. Some people who are all, you know, like in the thick of it, some teenager with his friggin', you know, toys, you know, or people in the thick of it aren't, you know, necessarily going to be aware.
Ability to achieve renewal. So if that's a really compelling key you laid out there, how would you recommend anyone, no matter where they are, and then we're going to dive into the Amazon, to connect with that key?
Well, for one, yeah, there's many. That's what the tradition, that's what the indigenous science is. The indigenous science is not so much the Cartesian and Western science that wants to, you know, name everything and see how it all works. The indigenous science is not such a, you know, theoretical science. It's more of a practical science. It wants to discover, you know, and prove the reality of renewal. It finds all the different methods that can be achieved. And each community, each indigenous community has their own basically approach to that. But also a lot of indigenous science are traditions, or ancient traditions that were, you know, in many cases, as in the case of the Sequoia people, these are traditions that they say, you know, were channeled through basically, you know, encounters with celestial immortals, with these entities, these spiritual beings are the core, central pillar of the indigenous science. And it's, you know, maybe we say science because it's in order to maybe give it more validity in a Western paradigm, but really it's a way of life. So you can, you know, the better thing is once we're interested, okay, yes, it's science, but it's actually a way of life. It's indigenous way of life. Because science, in a sense, isn't in the West, isn't a way of life. It's like a pursuit of knowledge that then people go back to driving their car to, you know, buying canned foods or, you know, whatever it is that, you know, colluding with basically. Well, it's well beyond repair at this point now. I mean, like, right now it's a mess over a mess. It's a problem stacked on top of a problem stacked on top of a problem stacked on top of a problem. It's like an Empire State Building. It's like a whole city of problems stacked on top. You know, I mean, in some regards, like just the other day, someone was mentioning what's the difference between Western, modern day like culture, which unfortunately, I mean, there's lots of cultures, but the predominant paradigm and what keeps alive like approach to global affairs in this day and age is this corporate pillage, corporate mining takeover, and basically, you know, culture of mass consumption, disposable culture of mass consumption that's fed and kept alive by the corporate mining paradigm. And that makes for a really pretty dangerous combination, as we can see.
Definitely. You're so sweet. So what can be our first step?
Someone asked me this question, how do you see the difference between indigenous way of life and different indigenous culture and what's happening now in the West with this like corporate, you know, consumer culture? But in a way, consumer corporate culture, like a paraplegic on a hospital bed being kept alive by all sorts of kind of medications and oxygen and only, you know, one eye is open and just like looking out. It's like that almost in a way, because it's we're living, you know, our whole system, modern day system now is based on an approach to, you know, interacting with the earth that's not sustainable, of we're pillaging the earth's limited renewable resources. So we have to make a shift towards sustainability at all costs. And I think that starts at that. It starts each person in their life, but it just, you know, has to see how we can ourselves, our life, and every aspect of our life towards living a life in sustainability.
What I was going to say is, if it's okay if I interject right now, is when you were talking about a way of life, like science being acquired knowledge in the West, and for all intents and purposes, parts of the East, it's an acquired system that was put in place but can be employed very easily if you study some of the different sciences as Ayurveda or Chinese medicine. My question for you is if you could extrapolate a little bit more, because when you were talking about a way of life this morning, I was just connecting to one of the Hopi leaders that I work with, and that, you know, their culture is very much about that, the way of life, and they actually, in their last migration pattern, because of how they were directed, went to the most desolate place ever, so life would not be easy for them. So they wouldn't lose that sacred relationship. And now you're talking about the way of life, the science, and it feels very similar, yet obviously very different when you're living in a jungle. So if you can share a little bit more about that from what you're from your experience of living in the Amazon, in the jungle, and with the indigenous, and how important that way of life is, knowing that it's very different than what most people are experiencing in urban city centers.
The Sequoias believe in the Winyapai. That's an interesting similarity with traditional Taoism, because that the fundamental approach to the traditions of always to merge with the energy of the celestial immortals, the divine immortals, and the Sequoia whole culture, and all the indigenous original cultures of the Amazon, probably the world over, to connect with the divine celestial immortals, or immortals of any legions. They're celestial immortals. But these are the immortals that transcend time and space. And there's celestial immortals in the sky. There's doctor people, celestial immortals in the water. There's celestial immortals inside the earth. The Haikunti Pai. So when they have their ceremonies and the way they dress too, you know, the Sequoias dress to cross necklaces, the colorful crowns with a blue band, red on the front and yellow on the side. And they wear tunics of many colors and cross necklaces. That was from an encounter with the Nyanye Sekopai, the gods, multicolored peoples. The Sequoias, they say, were a more primitive Sweden agricultural hunter-gatherer tribe that lived mainly in loincloths. But when they had this encounter with the Nyanye Sekopai, and after that, their culture evolved. They started to wear tunics, cross the crowns, and all that has a symbolic purpose, too. And each culture has its own approach. One of the Sequoia is very endemic in many regards to the Amazon, but now with ayahuasca traveling the world over, there's more interest in that, and that's actually happening all over the place. The grandmother medicine is lifting her wings and traveling worldwide on behalf of all kinds of interested folks. Some, you know, who want to share the medicine, others who want to take advantage of this to make, you know, money. But there's all sorts of different reasons. But now this plant medicines from the Amazon are traveling the world over, and people are having ceremonies everywhere. And that's definitely part of a greater plan of the plants wanting to reach out to protect themselves and consequently us as well. But the Sequoias, you know, their whole culture, that's a lot of what the book talks about, is like it's in the ceremonial tradition of the Sequoia people. And also now, since ayahuasca is traveling the world over, I felt it's kind of a sense of moral obligation to share the traditional, you know, certain elements of the traditional, basically, you know, approach to using this medicine, because they use it in such a way where their intentions are to, you know, basically become celestial immortals. And one achieves health, one gets healed, and it's not only a personal salvation, but it's an integral salvation. The community gets benefited, the landscape gets benefited, all living beings around ourselves are part of this benefit of this, of transformation, of sublimation, of integration towards the light, towards the creator. And if you look at it from a cosmic perspective, from a geological perspective, about one human life is just like a blink of an eye, and we're all life together, basically reaching towards an immortal light, and there's nothing that stops that. That's the way of the universe.
Which I love that how you put this all together, sharing their traditions. If you can share a little bit about set and setting, and I would love this to... One, I would love everyone to read this book, especially if they're going to go on the journey of ayahuasca. I've shared that with many people. That's really important to understand who's administering and what is behind what's being administered. But if you can share a little bit about that and of kind of like an ethical responsibility, and then also I'd be curious what your opinion is when, how powerful is the mother when it's not being held properly and things are going awry?
Before much later, we'll talk about, just to tally up on the last question just before moving on, is that these traditions from the Amazon are wordless traditions for the most part, and one has to spend a lot of time down there to learn them, and now this medicine is traveling, so the book is sort of like the shadow of the grandmother spirit bird that's circulating the world now to enlighten humanity into a new way of life. But because the teachings and the tradition are an essential part to help guide it towards the auspicious direction. But because it's, you know, basic and oral tradition, it's really important to reach towards other world traditions that are more well documented and have a longer history of documentation, such as the traditions of Taoism. And I think that there's a lot, also Ayurveda or Western, you know, other different like Eastern traditions and mysticism. They all basically have the fundamental lesson, any religion as well too, even if it be Catholicism, has the fundamental message of, you know, doing good, thinking good. So at the basis of it all is, you know, thinking good thoughts, saying good things, doing good deeds. But then there's many, many different practices that help actually achieve. One is, for example, like Tai Chi, or another is, you know, traditional Chinese massage, or Daoin, which is like a, or yoga. So I definitely highly recommend people in this time and age, you know, not to look only to Amazonian traditions, but that's also maybe a reason why the world is being, you know, kind of integrated, which is almost synonymous for destroyed in a way nowadays. But, you know, we have all these airplanes and all these cultures are coming together. But it's also so that all of humanity can have closer access to the time-tested traditions, and we can, of humanity, in a way reconfirms that it's really just one humanity and one world. But back to this, so the second question related to the ayahuasca traditionally is that, for sure, you know, these medicines have to be appropriate, and there's three fundamental pillars. And one of them is the way the medicine is prepared. And for this reason, chapter 5 is preparing a proper brew is in the book. And most people would not think like that some of the guidelines for the preparations you wouldn't ever even probably conceive of as being so important if you don't have experience with the sacred culture, the sacred way of life.
Yeah.
For example, when the medicine is cooked, the person can't walk around in a full circle behind the fire. And this is because, and Don Cesario's grandfather would leave two balsa trees, like leaving a trail behind the fire where the yahe was being cooked. And he would even make little holes in the balsa wood and he'd stick flowers in it. So it was like a runway for an airplane coming down the sides, you know, like a beautiful trail. And because it's believed that from there comes the celestial immortals. They need a trail to walk on that nobody's walked on. They're so sensitive and so pure that even if you just walk across that trail, if you cross it walking, they get to that spot and they don't know which way to go, to the right or to the left or straight into the pot of the yahe, so they return. This yahe makes the master feel only drunk, but he can't have visions. But it's there's a lot of things like that. So most people don't know that. The stuff is prepared and sent over in the mail. And a lot of, sometimes it doesn't travel that well. Some healers come up, or, you know, shamans, or even maybe people that aren't necessarily in their communities, quote unquote, you know, recognized shamans or healers or masters of this tradition, but they know enough about it. And since Westerners don't know that much, and so they travel and they share it, but they're not that versed or that skilled. And oftentimes they put other plants in there to make it stronger so it travels well, because they're concerned that, you know, maybe some, if they don't feel it, they'll want their money back. And there's a lot of different, basically, scenarios that can occur. But for the one thing, so the medicine has to be properly prepared. Secondly, the space has to be appropriate for the ceremony. And then the third is that the person who has to have understanding of a spiritual way of life who serves the medicine as well.
So, what does one do? Because you're saying, I'm aware of many in urban settings where the plant medicine is administered, but it's not necessarily upheld this way. So what would be your recommendation for listeners that have participated or are planning on participating in a ceremony to best prepare, or is it better just to go to the most authentic source, meaning going to the jungle?
You know, there's many situations occurring now, so I can't say what, you know, each one is different. People have to, you know, use their own sound judgment. You find a fully traditional situation is almost impossible now, and so it's definitely bending and there's many different traditions as well. There's a tradition of ayahuasca from the Incas that, you know, was taught to the Amahuacas and the Shipibos and then to the wave of foreigners going through Iquitos. And there's many people who are studying those traditions, and that's a different tradition than the Ayahuasca, because that's a tradition that stems from the Incas originally. They say that the ayahuasca comes from the grave of Michael Capac, the founding father of the Inca. When he died 800 years old, he summoned his disciple, Rumi, who then taught him the whole tradition. And the plants were growing out of his grave, both plants, so that the people could have the wisdom that he had. On the other hand, the Sequoia tradition is a celestially ordained tradition from an encounter of the Sequoias with the Nyan Yeshekopai, with the God's multicolored people, who taught the Sequoia how to drink the Yahe. But the God's multicolored people and all celestial immortals, basically, they're immortals because each moment is like a new life. Not only that, in one day, they die and are reborn thousands of times. Mm-hmm. And so they're in a constant state of renewal. That's why in the Sequoia tradition, they call the Winya Pai. Winya meaning ever fresh or new. Each moment is like a new life. Winya is like the flowering buds, a blossoming bud on a tree, or like the young growth of leaves in spring, or dew on leaves. Anything that's utterly pristine is Winya. And so that's the energy that, you know, when you encounter the Winya Pai, that's the person that achieves total renewal. But first, before meeting the Winya Pai, one has to heal oneself. So the whole tradition is a discipline towards being like independent, that work hard every day, that think positive thoughts, that integrate each aspect of being to a positive way of life, so that they can live very humbly, modestly, a service-oriented perspective. They awaken the culture of service. All these are prerequisites as one goes strengthening one's chi, one's energy level, one goes serving more, every day helping people in secrecy, and then do many acts of kindness and good deeds. And one goes progressing on the path, one meets the celestial immortals, and then one becomes very strong, and one understands the true essence of life. Mm-hmm.
In your book, well, towards the end, because when I realized we were going to do this, I'm like, okay, I got to check out the last chapter before we started. I want to go twofold. One, service, about service, and how that's enriched your life, and how you feel that is a key, if you feel, is that a key to living a symbiotic relationship, not only with others, but with nature?
Essentially, the culture of service is one where we don't only think about our own needs, but also consider the needs of others, because by doing that, we verify the unity of all things. Right now we have problems because there's too many people trapped in a dualistic perspective, me, you, good, bad. The indigenous science teaches that essentially we're all unified. That still doesn't mean that I'm not me and you're not you. And so it's for more reason, since we're all unified and we are in an individualistic form, we have to be very disciplined. Ways, but through enacting service, even like, for example, in this, there's a style of scripture that Kenyan pin, it means straighten your way. And this strict scripture talks about the importance of doing good deeds, virtuous acts of fulfillment every day, three good deeds in secrecy. If you do this for 3 years, you can achieve health and longevity. It says, if three good deeds, or if one accumulates 3,000 subtle good deeds, which is a good deed that one does that affects many other people, one can become an immortal. It says in this Taoist scripture. And essentially, that's a way of connecting with positive spirits, because the auspicious positive spirits, their concern is to assist humanity, to save people from misery, to help all the people achieve happiness and peace. And so by enacting that, like, basically full way of life, then we come closer and closer to the celestial energies. And we can become healthier and happier ourselves too. And we can feel more intimate and closely related to nature. Nature begins to respond. You have intimate encounters with animals. And many phenomena and beautiful things happen to one that enrich one's life beyond the ability to describe in words.
And explain the importance of secrecy I know the answer, I think, but I want to hear it from you. how you were saying, because you mentioned it a couple times and in that passage about doing good deeds in secrecy, which I think you mean anonymously.
Yeah, especially though what it means is to do good deeds and just drop it afterwards. Many people do good deeds and they the flag and they slap the flag to see what we've done, but it's important to do it and move on.
I agree. Now, the other part I want to ask you about, since you're talking about the celestial immortals, which really stood out to me because I had this experience recently in this Bolivian artist's backyard. He has a bunch of sugar cane growing, and I was born in Hawaii. And the whole time I was interviewing, they kept dancing for me. And I haven't been around sugar cane since I lived in Hawaii, like that. If you can share a little bit, because in the book it made me smile. You were talking about the sugar cane and the peppers and these certain plant combinations that give access to these celestial beings. If you can share a little bit more about that.
The plant combinations you're saying?
Yeah, I wish I had the page, but I don't. You talked about having the sugar cane, I think it was the cayenne.
Yeah.
And I want to say...
Oh, the origin of the plant.
Well, and the combination of them being together, or if I wasn't even reading that correctly.
Yeah.
But the significance of those. And then you even noted that someone in their practice, when he was going back to being in the world more, how he took the lemon and the salt and the cayenne. So if you could just share a little bit more about those plants and their use in relationship to living, to the plant medicine.
Well, there's one, there's that origin legend of the Shiwa Marun, the mother, the fertility mother that's slain by the seven-headed bow, Atacapia, which is the bow of disintegration and destruction. But so that's, and then when it was from its heart, it came growing these seven plants, which are the ayahuasca, the admixture plant, the amiruka panga, and then sugarcane, and also chili peppers, dunduma, which is like this medicinal hedge, and I think there was a banana variety, ginger too, spicy ginger. So
yep, that's right.
But
good job.
But it's interesting because, I mean, I'm sure there's much more to this than I know, too, as well. I'm just a student of this scene, and the elders can explain it at depth. There is, you know, it is interesting that the seven heads of the boa, you know, can represent possibly like the seven main principal chakras. Some traditions like recognize nine, but pretty much seven is like main principal chakras.
Mm-hmm.
Also, like if the directions, you can look at north, south, east, west, above, below, and then encompassing of them all is seven. So seven is a sacred number in indigenous cosmology. And the seven-headed boa, you know, has seven heads that aren't in agreement. They're all fighting and biting each other, and it causes destruction wherever it goes. And then the Shiwa Marun was like this fertility boa whose scales like chime together and make beautiful sounds, and it wherever it went underneath the earth, it would make everything fertile and ultra green, and people's gardens would just produce abundantly. And so it represented a time when people were still in touch with unicity, and when the phenomena the result of that is that it's a worldview of total abundance. There's no need for fear because everything is for everyone. But then the other worldview is that a duality of me, you, there's only enough for me. So people start fighting over resources and there's not enough for everybody to go around. And then it comes fear. It's one of fear. And so essentially it's representing the time of when this, you know, of an end of that, like, you know, kind of golden age of abundance, everything for everybody. But as a result too, and in order to ameliorate and going to enter a time of difficulty, of chaos, there's these plants. And we know that. So the ayahuasca and the admixture plant come from the heart of the, you know, this, in order to awaken the knowledge of that they're, you know, tap into that, at least temporarily, and harness that to the best ability that we can, that vision of abundance, that there's really, you know, there's no lack and that there's enough for everybody, but not from the perspective of, you know, everybody has their own car, everybody has their own cell phone, and then, you know, taxing the earth. It comes from a perspective of, because the only way to touch that is through the dieta, dieting. And so one has to abstain from many earthly pleasures, from many, you know, basically, you know, luxuries in order to tap into that energy of, there's, you know, of complete abundance. Because that energy is only found in celestial realms. In order to anchor that on the earth, we have to live a life of utter modesty. The less we eat, the less resources we use. So it's really a totally flip coin approach to the, you know, like sort of like the consumer culture approach that there's enough for everybody, but through this like disposable, you know, approach that, oh, it's broken, throw it away, grab another, you know, without any awareness of where the broken thing gets thrown or what gets broken in the process of obtaining all these goods, you know? And so basically, so then one, but then at the same time, so it's a balance between energy, the celestial energy and the earthly energy. Earthly energy is, you know, more stagnant and more, you know, slower, but, you know, in the sense that it's, you know, it's not at the realms of like, the, you know, it's an energetic, basically, worldview of the, from physical to the most grotesque physical to the physical and to the most sublime, and then to the realms transcendent of time and space. The earth is like somewhere in between. Below us are heavier, more denser energy realms of the realms of ghosts and demons. Above us are more sublime energy realms of nature spirits. Above that is mountain spirits and starry beings. Then the realms transcendent of space and time, and then the immortals. And so it's easier for humans to have contact with the lower energies, either below or above. But it's not difficult. It's much more difficult for humans to transcend through, break through that veil of that time and space from the realms of that are governed by time and space. So that's why it's much more difficult to, you know, basically have communion with celestial immortals. It's much easier to have, you know, encounters with terrestrial spirits. And that's, you ask, you know, some of the problems. Ayahuasca itself is not that of a problem. And you drink too much, you vomit. As long as you don't drown in your own vomit, you're laying face up. Mm-hmm. You're just going to vomit and it'll pass. You'll be fine. The problem is more that ayahuasca is a porthole. It opens people up. And people are confused. People are power hungry. They don't know it. People are desperate. They don't know it. People who are overprivileged want more. They don't know it. There's all these hidden agendas that people aren't aware of that we have because of societal conditioning, which can allow people to merge and marry into lower energy levels, because the spirits and negative spirits, they really can't. They're kind of harmless. They have to interact in the world through physical form, but they almost do it. It's like it's all a process towards global sublimation. Even that is a part of the process, because if you fell, then they make you fall even farther until you die or get burned so that you can like go back to the right way of kind of life. It's kind of like that, you know?
Right. You're funny. I'm totally with you.
And that's good that we're laughing, because that really is like the elders are always joyous.
Yeah.
And we have to keep things light. That's one of the most important things. If we're renewed, we're laughing, we have to touch that energy, and it's a good thing. But, you know, back to your question about the ginger and the cayenne, that was a specific, and there's other plants too, like the ginger helps to make life more vibrant. Like sometimes our energy level gets a little stagnant, we can drink some ginger, it helps warm the blood, as well as chili peppers in a tropical environment to help keep the spleen dry. So that is good for aiding, you know, the digestion, absorption of nutrients, which is vital, of course, for staying healthy and living a vibrant life. And then sugar cane, you know, nothing like, you know, is very useful in for many things, you know, with it's a medicine, and it can be used industrially, and it's also, you know, basically food, and it's the brain depends on, you know, sugars in different forms to function properly. So that, you know, no surprise that sugarcane comes from the glistening fertility boa mother as well, the Shio Amarun Dumduma, which is an anti-parasitic sense, because if you have parasites stopping your energy, you can't meet the celestial mortals, you can't achieve that lifestyle. And then so all these plants that you see are you know, related to ayahuasca, but the ayahuasca is not something in and of itself. It's a way of life that we, you know, that allows one to arise and tap into the energies of renewal. And how do we do that? Yoked with the energies of the celestial realms, letting spirit guide matter, not matter guide spirit. But then since we live in earthly existence, and sometimes it's hard to be too pure in this earthly realm, and it's a process of going back and forth, and we can't, like, be complete. We're not, you know, like celestial immortals. We're not celestial immortals on the earth. We're human mortals trying to achieve health and make a better world of with our lives. So then that's why, you know, after breaking fast, after doing these diets, the chili peppers with a little bit of salt and lemon come in handy, because those, they seal the body. And they, like, because they're very pungent aromas. When one does fasting and dieting, you know, you abstain from salt, you abstain from lemon and chili pepper, because these are very, like, kind of pungent. They stimulate, they're, like, stimulating. And so one, and by stimulating one, they kind of make one more present in the earthly sphere. So they're used to break the diet.
Mm. And can you share from your own experience how you've experimented with diet and living a simplistic life, and where that's given you more alignment with self and access to some of these realms that you're speaking about?
You know, I know a lot about this theoretically, you know, from entering the elders and from studying, you know, but like another whole other thing is practically. And but, you know, so I wouldn't say like I'm a shaman or any of that. I would never go so far. I'm just a student of traditional medicine. But yeah, the diets are really important for one's personal health, and they make you feel much, much better. And when you take on these diets, you feel strong and healthy. But it's good to, you know, not to overdo it. You go, you know, it's good to go kind of more in the middle of the road and do some diets, and then kind of live regular, do some diets, go back and forth like that. Not to, it's not advisable to go too fast or try to want to achieve too much, but just to go, to be honest with it.
And for you on this journey, because you're obviously have had such a unique life, being how you grew up. I remember, I think you said in the jungle, I was a kid that had the lizard under my shirt, you know, going to school in Ecuador, you know, as you're making dyes for plants for a kids' camp that were coming in. If you can share how, you know, your journey with the plant medicines has, you know, made you even more passionate about your life purpose this time around, and how you hope that it could potentially touch others in the future.
Well, you know, we have this opportunity in Costa Rica where people, you know, with the traditional elders, they come, and that's an opportunity. We also do these tours to Ecuador, so that's a way of people to you know, open up. That's, we can't, you know, bring that many people there, because it's so limited of enrollment, but it's an opportunity for people to meet the rainforest firsthand and to experience, you know, a way of life that's really moving. And what's amazing is that it's an important eye-opener. And we find that when people come on our retreats, they always, it helps them in ways where, like, you can say to me, what's your advice? What do you suggest to me in order to improve my life or help me find happiness or fulfilled? And that, you know, ultimately no one can say, only each person is so unique, each situation is so different. But having an experience, a wilderness experience with the elders, and laughing a lot and experience the forest and doing the renewal ceremonies and taking medicinal plants, one comes back enlivened and rich. And then many of one's life quests and maybe inner answers that maybe one didn't even know one had are answered in a natural, simple way, and one feels contented and fulfilled. So I would recommend anybody who wants to have a first-hand experience to consider joining us on one of our retreats, and that's what we're setting up this business to help people experience nature. In Costa Rica, we have the lodge, and we do once a year visits down to the villages in Ecuador, and we now have the Guayusa tea that's made available as well, and that's actually a whole other theme of discussion, the Guayusa.
Yes. I love the Guayusa. That would be a whole other radio show. It's worth just going down to see you and have tea at 4:30 in the morning when the wrens get up. Jonathan, if you can share, because I know we're coming up on time, I would love to know what animal has been, or animals, maybe it's not just one, has been a guide for you, and what wisdom has been kind of shown to you through that animal.
One of the elements of the tradition that that we practice is that in the Sequoia tradition, also the traditions of Tao that I've been studying, is that it's a little precarious to align too much with a specific animal. But it's good to know that each animal is medicine. Every animal, not one animal, is left out, from the smallest to the biggest, is medicine. And yeah, we have our own ways of being, so we'll like, you know, maybe identify closer with other animals, and it's okay too as well. But it's also a little dangerous to take on animal forms, because if one does so, one can also succumb the danger that they are succumbing at this time. So it's a little better to, you know, take on more the approach of the human form, of which is the integration of our three chakras into an integrated whole being that dedicates oneself to protecting all life forms. And if one wants to study animals, to not get, you know, not go too deep into one, but to go studying many of the different medicines of the different animals. So with that, I could say that I could share just a little bit of medicine about what animal medicine is, like, for example. But also now, you know, animal medicine talks about all the animals, not just animals that are in one part of the world, but animals from the world over. Mm. And so, like, for example, the jaguar is one that represents primal energy. That's why the Sequoias consider, you know, their worldview is like a jaguar-centric worldview where everything is energy. Mm. For example, you know, there's many different kinds of jaguars in the Sequoia cosmology. One represents a different, like, manifestation of primal energy, from the water jaguar to the jaguar mother. They each have their own names. The crab jaguar in the water that has a story. I write about that in the book a lot.
Yes, you did.
The enthrallment jaguar, too, which is a really dangerous jaguar that approaches during times of war and like, simulates, you know, destruction, basically, and aggressiveness. But it's interesting that it's called the enthrallment jaguar. And someone gets too enthralled with primal energy, you know, you can get possessed by this enthrallment jaguar. These, like, African warlords, for example, what's going on there and stuff, you know. And then the ancient shamans would defer these bad jaguars with their ceremonial way of life so they wouldn't come close to the earth. And they were, you know, creating peace for generations in their villages. But then there's other insects, like the cicada, for example. The cicada is medicine. It represents the cicada people, the concubine, which I talk about in the book as well. And that's like, it's a realm, a celestial realm that comes close to the earth certain times of the year. The river otters are very beautiful too. The river otters, according to the Waurani tradition, worldview, are the grandchildren of the creator. And there's an amazing legend of the river otter that actually remade a grandfather creator, because grandfather creator was sending the floods and destroying the people. And it's quite incredible. The woodpecker is an amazing bird too, that according to Waurani legend, the earth was lifted up, the hills of the Amazon were formed to follow and mimic the flight of the woodpecker, which flies like up, like kind of lopes down and lopes and then kind of springs back up, so it makes the shape of the hills and the rivers.
Well, what you've created down there is really, my first impression was it felt like the Garden of Eden. So I'm sure it's only has even more depth now than it did then, or maybe, I don't know, but really amazing.
It's truly amazing. What's so nice about it too is that the animals there are protected and people don't hunt there. So you see abundance of all kinds of animals and privilege to see animals that are not afraid, that are curious, want to meet you. Monkeys come right up and, like, are looking at you, and everything is, like, in harmony, in balance.
Yes.
And in that, which is a very rare thing to find in the tropics, because most of the tropical regions the world over are right now fraught with complexities, deforestation, mining, intertribal warfare, or if not physical, like, you know, mad, you know, spiritual intertribal warfare. It's amazing. The Sequoia elders, when they came lodge in our region, they say it was the first time that they could see the celestial immortals accompanying some of the people, some of the old timers in the area that went to visit them. Don Society said, wow, the Winyapine are, I've never seen the Winyapine accompany the Ankebine, the white people.
Mm. We're going to put all the links below where to find you and how to get this beautiful book that you wrote. I have a self-indulgent question. This is how we're going to sign out. Well, there's different varieties, but I'm just going to call it the angel trumpet.
Yeah, there's a whole many varieties of species.
And I'm just very curious about this flower, and if you could share any wisdom, as it's featured in your book, you took several pictures of it, if you could just share any wisdom about it.
Plant is very dangerous, so you have to be very careful with this plant. Bernantia is quite dangerous. You have to be very careful with this plant because it's it can have very dangerous consequences, side effects, and those are only taken basically by ancestral varieties are used in very strict ceremonies that people prepare all year long for. It mustn't be taken lightly. It's very dangerous, but people in the West and like any odd variety of Bergmannia for like people like can be used medicinally for sprains and bruises, but only externally. The stems are pounded up, and that can be heated, like steamed, and then that can be placed on a sprain wrapped on. And it's very good for animals in particular, because they're closer to spirit and they do more like diet. They don't eat so much junk food like we do. The animals can, like if a dog or a horse sprains its knee or leg or anything, that's very, very good. Made a poultice of the whole plant, the leaves. But in traditional context, like amongst the sequoias, they would do graduation ceremonies where they would take this plant, but 40 whole plants, and they, if they vomit, you have to vomit into the gourd and slam it back down, because if you don't drink enough, they say the spirit gets caught halfway, and whatever vice that person has, like if they, are always cleaning the patio with their machete, they'll be like all curled up in the corner, swinging their arm, like if they were cleaning the patio. I heard this story about this Argentinian guy who rolled sick, and he wanted to try, and he tried, but he couldn't drink it all, vomited, and then he was like all curled up in the corner for like 4 days, like rolling invisible smokes. But if the disciples that managed to drink the whole lot, or if not vomit, then they like die for like the whole day, and their spirit journeys. And the master the whole time is only drinking the yahe and guiding their spirit. And that's, they use that for the graduation ceremonies to meet the demon king, which is a deity of the Sequoia tradition that is responsible for wizardly healing, that with the shamans that befriend and have communion with the demon king can heal any kind of illness.
Is this where you mention about, is this the same deity that takes your heart and you're supposed to take theirs and then give it back?
That's it.
That's really powerful.
Yeah, very, very powerful.
I think everyone's calling you in. It's a tradition?
Yeah, that's part of the ancient Sequoia healing tradition. That's an objective of the path of healing, when they get to a point where they have to undergo graduation ceremonies with the Pehi, with Bergmannia, and in order to meet the demon king. Once the person meets the demon king, then he can heal through the use of ayahuasca, of course, through Yahe, pretty much any illness, but just very few elder healer masters that have gone that far.
Sound pretty epic to me.
Yeah, it's cool. It's an amazing thing. It really is a phenomena of the basically existence.
Yes, definitely. Well, Jonathan, I don't want to take up too much more of your time, because I really appreciate this serendipitously working out on your visit up here on the North American continent. And I just want to pay complete gratitude for you creating this beautiful, really an archive and wealth of information for others to really educate themselves on things that they might be indulging in, so they have a little bit more wisdom behind them. So thank you.
Yeah, one of the things, what I noticed, that like a lot of people have a lot of concern for the forest and would love to see it saved, but like live their lives day by day and can't break out of it. Other people, I think that the people who are experimenting with ayahuasca, with yahe, ultimately if they drink strong and think enough of a dose, they're going to wake up to the cultural service. Some of these people might be able to finagle, energy towards the conservation of the rainforest go down there or support nonprofit groups or become part of a community project. And so like this, the world is going to integrate. It's kind of a long shot, but it's not impossible. And so we have those hopes because we can't lose faith that, now that the world has come together and, there's like this amazing communication system, Skype and telephones, and we can travel almost anywhere. Hopefully, that same infrastructure can be used somehow to, make the shift. And I think people experiment with these plants, if they use it properly, will have much more energy, will be in a more auspicious position to basically allow this shift to occur, to usher in the shift. So to all those who are ushering the shift, more energy, more power, more success. Now they say, the elders say, that the mysterious mother, she's bringing all her children under her wing. Now is the most crucial time. We can't hopefully even waste one moment in being part of ushering this shift towards sustainability. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And I want to once again thank Jonathan for joining us today. If you're inspired by his wisdom, please support his work by checking out the links below. Buy the book and go visit him in Costa Rica, whatever inspires you. And we are going to sign out with a little music from Ecuador, Manta, Cuatro Esquinas. And why don't you just sit back and imagine being in the rainforest, being in the Amazon, and connecting to the medicine of the plants.